This is an interview with Mr. Fred Auger, or Auger, A-U-G-E-R, on the 10th of May, 1966.
3 p.m. tomorrow.
Yeah.
Now, so we can talk along.
Okay, how are you getting along with the project?
Well, I've had, to date, I've had about 32 interviews with General Crooks himself.
Uh-huh.
And about half a dozen interviews with other people, his wife, his sister, his former Batman in World War I, one or two other people.
Wow.
I'm to see tomorrow Air Vice Marshal Howsam, H-O-W-S-A-M, who's living here. He was the one who took Perks up on his first flight.
Oh?
I don't know if you know him or not.
No, I don't. Name is vaguely familiar to me. Well, that's very interesting. I wondered what inspired you to do this, where you first made his acquaintance and realized there was a story there.
I have been after him. On and off, I'd say for about 3 years, trying to get them, because I teach BC history, and there's damn little being written in it, quite frankly.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
BC Historical Quarterly is not coming out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I suppose it's some sort of an inner urge. I thought he had a story that deserved to be told.
Oh, yeah, I think it's a tremendous story of a person.
It is.
And I've described him as a great Canadian, even though he is not Canadian-born.
No.
We've got a few historians around our building. Of course, Bruce Ramsey is on our staff.
Is he?
He's done the ghost towns of B.C., and he did history of the Pacific Great Eastern Railway, and had one other thing was, and Patty Sherman has just produced prolifically two books. And
just reading his
bang,
latest
bang.
For review in the Times, in the in the Victoria
Times.
You're
doing a review on that, good.
And I find it fascinating.
Yeah. You know, I read the transcription, the manuscript before it went to printers, and I thought it was pretty good. We were sensitive about it because we didn't want to give anybody the feeling that, that the newspaper was influencing the text at all, and that his association with the newspaper's policy, it would be kept out of the book. And we also discovered since that we have a little trouble convincing people that the book wasn't subsidized by the Social Credit Party or the newspaper.
Good Lord, anybody who read the book would.
Yeah, well, that's what I said. I've said a few people have suggested this, and I said, look, read the book and then come back and tell me. And on the other hand, Bennett was pretty broad-minded about it. He kidded Patty and said, I'm going to sue you for $1 million, and laughed. And but at the launching luncheon a week of Friday, this was, he said he thought it was fine. He was flattered that anybody would care to write a book about him, and so on. He'd take the good with the bad, I guess.
There is another man who deserves a book.
Yeah.
I mean, this, to my mind, now I've read about 4/5 of it to date, at least. In fact, I've only got more than that because I have about only 20 or 30 pages to go.
Yes.
And I would definitely say that this is the best book that has been produced on a B.C., a major figure in B.C.
Yeah.
Period.
Well, that's a great compliment. I had lunch yesterday with Lee Briggs, who was here as the chairman of the B.C. Hydro Commission, the B.C. Power Commission, until 1958 when he had a great blow-off with Bennett, because Bennett was, in his claim, diverting funds from Power Commission for other purposes and so on, and it distorted the performance picture of the Power Commission. Anyway, he left, and I was curious to know what his reaction was, because that is reviewed, his squabble with Bennett was reviewed in the book, and he thought it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
He thought it was that he'd been presented very fair. So did everybody so far. So I think that's pretty good over a figure that's so controversial and
that's
still a living figure,
and
in the community. That so far I haven't run across anybody that claimed any distortion.
Well, of course, this from an historian's point of view, I'm not going to attempt to review it as a piece of history or as an official biography because you can't.
No.
He doesn't quote his sources, I think wisely, perhaps.
Yeah.
Now, any good historian, of course, would want facts and figures and where the documents are. Where's your proof for this?
Yeah.
Well, now, he says, I think in his, in his introduction, but this is not a history as such, nor indeed could it be a history as such.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I don't think an historian could do as good a job.
Well, just take a chunk out of a man's life, and while he's still living and still in the position to put him there and so on, and do it without a lot of controversy, I think it's pretty good.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, now, how did he... am I right in thinking, and I get this assumption from reading the book, that by far the greater part, I would say, I would estimate 90% of the information he got... would be from personal sources, from interviewing people, that sort of thing.
Yes, I think that's right. But Paddy's got a very clear mind, he's a clear thinker. And I think he's a very impartial thinker, too, which is a pretty good thing. He's one of the few newspaper men in B.C. who is not only competent, but fast in shorthand.
Is he?
And when he was in the gallery here for a long time, you know, he was... when there was anything really hot going on, they'd look up and they'd see Paddy writing like crazy, and then they'd come up the next day and ask him for a transcript of what he, well, the thing, because there's no Hanser record here, there's no tape recording or anything. And it got that Paddy was practically the unofficial Hanser of the house, because nobody questioned. If they went to him and said, have you got any record of what so-and-so said a week ago or a month ago or last year or 3 years ago? As long as Paddy had been there, and if he had a record, he could turn it out. And nobody questioned that. He had his shorthand right there, and had nobody in the house ever questioned if Sherman brought it up or unearthed it, you know.
Yeah.
And this is in the book. See, there's a lot of...
That's it.
A lot of stuff in the book that struck me. Nobody
that,
can question the vital things, and...
But there's one or two others. For example, he quotes verbatim a telegram sent by Bonner to Sturdy or someone or other, and I can only assume that Bonner must have either read that into the record in the house or loaned him the paper or something.
Yeah.
It could quite easily be.
Yeah, I think he got a fair amount of cooperation because they didn't always like the our newspaper's attitude editorially toward the policies of the government, but they always respected Paddy.
I'm glad somebody's done a book on him.
Yeah.
And as I say, it's the best I've read so far on any figure, and that goes from Dr. Sage's book on Sir James Douglas or what have you. Emma? Okay. He's going to do a book on H.H. Stevens. Another one of the fellows in the department.
Yeah.
But I think we better get down to general Perks. Now, Perks mentioned you in one of the early interviews I had, and as I think I mentioned in my letter, he has a photograph of you. I think there's you and then either Major or Colonel Perks, both on board a Colonel Perks, would it be, both on a horse. And you, if I remember, were in a cloth cap, shirt,
I think I've got that picture.
Knickerbockers.
Yeah.
I think they call them knickerbockers, or the...
Riding breeches?
No, not riding breeches.
Oh.
The fact that went down just below the knee.
Oh, yes, yeah. That's what we wore as kids in those days, sure.
Now, actually, for myself, the 1920s... For the period of the 1930s, I have to rely almost entirely on him and on his memory, so that any material I can get from persons such as yourself who knew him will all add to fill in gaps or what have you. So I would be interested in anything you have to say about him from the very first time you met him, how he impressed you, his character, what he did, and so on.
Yeah.
Which is a tall order.
Well, I remember it very clearly. My first meeting with Perks. Here's a picture of him. There, he taught me how to ride.
Oh, yeah.
But 1921, my father came back from overseas in 1919. And He died in November 1920 as a result of the war, and 1921, the spring of 1921. Playing on the street we lived in a very modest class part of Calgary. I don't know if we were playing baseball or something like that, two or three kids, and Perks came along the street. He was certainly a handsome guy. And
was he?
Oh, yeah, very handsome man, and a real figure of a man, too. He, in his colonel's military uniform with a staff epaulets, you know, the red mm-hmm. flashes on the cap mm-hmm. and the epaulets, and the officers in those days always wore riding breeches and highly polished riding boots, you know.
Yeah.
He was a sparse figure, no spare weight on him, and really a very handsome man. Well, he just was a passerby as far as we were concerned. But he stopped in a very friendly way, started talking to us. And I think probably we'd seen him going back and forth on this street for some time, and assumed that he lived in the neighborhood. He said something about, do you fellas have any Boy Scouts around here? We didn't, and he said, would you be interested in starting a Boy Scout troop? Well, we would, and so he invited us to come over to his apartment. He lived in an apartment, really it was an upper floor, some rooms in the upper floor of a two-story home in the neighborhood. It hadn't been rented to him for quarters. He invited us to come over one evening, maybe that evening, and bring along any boys who'd be interested. So we rounded up maybe half a dozen or a dozen boys in the neighborhood and said we came over to talk to them. But this was the founding of the what became the 14th Troop Boy Scouts of Calgary. And see, no man ever put his heart into a project and for benefit of young people more than he did. And right from the word go, he was just ahead of us all the time in enthusiasm mm-hmm. and leadership. And he was single, of course, in those days. And in no time at all, we had this troop built up to, I think it was about 35 boys, and that was the limit.
Wow.
And from then on, we as long as that troop remained in existence, we always had a waiting list.
Is that right? Can I interrupt here and ask a question? Was it connected in any way with a church?
No.
It wasn't?
No, we had to find a place to hold our meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little frame congregational church that had a Sunday school room in the basement, which was suitable for this sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the cold weather, but this was not in any sense affiliated with the church. It was just that the church people were kind enough to let us use these quarters, and we met on Saturday nights. This I didn't appreciate at the time either. Saturday nights is the night when most kids get into trouble.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't know whether he chose that or not, but it was suitable for him, and it was certainly most suitable for us.
Mm-hmm.
And our scout meetings were on Saturday night. I think we had a few church parades and probably went to that church, rarely, as I recall it. But most of our scouting projects were as a troop as a whole, were on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
As he was general staff officer of the Military District 13, with headquarters in the Central Armories in Calgary, not too far away from the community there. And there was a couple of companies there of the Lord Strathcona Horse.
Oh, yeah.
Were stationed there, and their mounted regiment. They had stables nearby and so on, and they were quartered in that armories, and the men were.
Mm-hmm.
And because of his position, he had access to a lot of recreation facilities. The result was that the physical training instructor on the staff of the Army was our physical training instructor for gymnasium classes, and another man was a range officer, and we used the rifle range for our rifle shooting training in the basement of the armories. Gee, there were officers, an awful lot of the military officers there gave time to us. It was wonderful, too. You know, fellows like engineers who would take a night off and come over to the scouts and talk to us about building a bridge out of sticks and, that kind of project. We had a band, and, of course, the bandmaster was the Army Sergeant Major of the band. We had a bugle band, that was, bugles and drums, and this training all came from the Army. I often think now that probably in the context of today's scandals, you know, are they this business of finding horses on the payroll at Petawawa Camp that some politician might have screamed about Army facilities being used rather than strictly for Army purposes. But there, I know that all of these Army men who did do anything for us did it on their own time. And because they like perks, and he inspired their interest in the boys, and the boys' projects. Well, it was just a tremendous thing for me. I just lost my father, and this man was just my idol, and he sort of, in a sense, not in any parental sense, but in the sense of an adult man being an inspiration for a boy, he. Mm-hmm. He gave me what I'd lost in the loss of my father, and we just idolized him. Well, we had winter camps where we took off after Christmas in the depth of winter, and wearing all the clothes we could pile on, and dragging sleighs behind us, and went off into the country and set up bivouac camps in zero and sub-zero weather. We had Easter camps when the ice wasn't off the river, and we'd go out and bivouac and so on.
Good God.
We had midsummer camps every year, different places in the hills surrounding, or the foothills, or the edge of the mountains surrounding Calgary. Some delightful memories of those. Uh-huh. And the Army... we used Army tents, Army bedding, Army stoves, Army cooking equipment, and Army vehicles, in many cases, got us there, and Army vehicles brought us back, and so on. Again, it was certainly a very great thing. Well,
he'd be with you all the time on these.
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. He had, from time to time, he brought in, was able to enlist the help of older young men who would come in and spend time as sort of an assistant scoutmaster. Mm-hmm. We had two or three assistants in that period that we were with him. Mm-hmm. We all were of the same age at the start, and we were pretty well all of the same age when the thing wound up, and that would be from the... I was 14 when I started with him, and... it lasted about 4 years, and we were just growing out of the age where we, you know, the boys were adolescing and maturing, and where they wanted to be Boy Scouts anymore. Mm-hmm. And the climax came in 1924, I believe it was, when Sir Robert Baden-Powell made his trip across Canada. It was his last trip, probably his only trip, maybe, the founder of the Boy Scouts, and in each principal center, the Boy Scouts put on some kind of a show for him. Mm-hmm. And Perks, by this time, had not only become, he'd become a very prominent figure in the whole Boy Scout movement in Alberta, because he had done so much with this one troop that we were miles ahead of any other troop organization in the community. And he organized this Boy Scout Jamboree, which was a gymkhana sort of affair, a one-night stand put on in the big hockey arena in Calgary. Mm-hmm. for the entertainment and the benefit of Sir Robert Baden-Powell, and the place was packed with public attendance, and the boys from all the troops throughout the area put on various kinds of demonstrations, gymnastics, and campfire making, rubbing two sticks together and all that sort of thing, and displays of one kind or another. And the highlight of it was this riding team. They had a very good riding instructor at Lord Strathcona Horse, and he took on a group of us. No, thank you. He took on a group of us and trained us to do a gymkhana riding stunt using these Lord Strathcona Horse mounts.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a picture of that here somewhere. This is it.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I think you probably have seen those pictures in his album, too.
I know he has several of those.
Well, this was the team. There were seven of us, and I was the small fry, so I was on the first horse.
Mm-hmm.
And this was this business where you ride in a circle and you leap off the horse and hit the ground and on again. And off the horse and over the other side and on again, and riding the horse standing up, your arms folded and so on. The horse goes cantering around the circle. It was quite a show. And,
it would be. I bet you brought the host down.
Yeah, I think it was quite a success, and it was quite a show. Well,
it must have been
outstanding. One of the principal figures in the community about that time in Calgary was R.B. Bennett, who later became Prime Minister of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a friend of Perks.
Mm-hmm.
He saw the show, and he thought that this thing should carry on, and that these boys doing this thing, and that was the year of the Wembley exhibition. And Robert Baden-Powell got back to Britain, and he sent a message back, as I recall, asking if this Boy Scouts team, this riding team of ours from Calgary, could come over and put on the this affair, this show, at the Wembley Exhibition in London. Of course, we were thrilled, so we carried on with our training, and the idea was that we weren't going to take our horses over there.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was promised that they could provide mounts for us in Britain for the purpose. A matter of money, Perks started talking with the men and throughout the community, and R.B. Bennett agreed to pick up the tab for part of it, and the late Senator Pat Burns from Calgary was prepared to underwrite part of it, and so on. And we kept on training. Now, this thing, as I recall, we put on originally about in March or something like that, and we were working hard at about May, or the end of May. Our hearts just went out of our chest because suddenly the word came through that Perks had been transferred away from the district, away from Calgary, and the whole thing fell apart.
Oh, shit.
We tried to hold the troop together by forming a sort of a senior Boy Scouts thing, a rover. Mm-hmm. Rover boys, or rover scouts, they call them, which is to fill in a couple of the years beyond the normal Boy Scout age.
Mm-hmm.
We got that started, but the spirit was gone when Perks left, and the thing ended there and came apart. That really was the story of his life, as far as I was concerned, in Calgary. He was very fond of horses and a great horseman. You know the history of that,
yes.
Of course. And he kept a couple of riding horses, and I apparently had some unusually, maybe a little more than average ability in horsemanship. And he took a fancy to teaching me to ride properly. And during the weather permitting, and I used to ride with him two or three mornings a week. I'd get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and ride for an hour and a half or 2 hours before school. And Sundays, weekends, when there were no scout activities on, we did an awful lot of hiking on Saturdays. We'd set a rendezvous, and the boys would all zero in there at 9 or 9:30 on a Saturday morning, and we'd go tailing off into the country, usually with Perks with us, to some place where we explored something and cooked a meal and straggled home in the late afternoon or after dark. And on the days we did that, that would be our scout meeting.
Mm-hmm.
If there wasn't a project of that kind on a Saturday, well, the normal scout meeting would be on Saturday night. I had more than, by far more than average attention from him. I lived nearby, and I was, I guess it started because I'd lost my father, and just about time he came into the picture.
Mm-hmm.
But he was remarkable, really, inspiring these boys to bring out the best in them.
I hear this, I've written to a great many people, dozens, quite frankly, of all the people I can lay my hands on who served with him or who knew him, and this is the same story that comes back from every single individual.
Yeah.
It's something that's hard to catch in a book.
I think it would be, and I think this Boy Scout thing would be, because the average attitude of the male animal who is not organization-minded toward the Boy Scouts is that it's a pretty prissy kind of a thing. But anybody who's been in the movement, of course, does understand it.
Mm-hmm.
They also understand the problems of the Boy Scout movement, which is entirely a matter of getting leadership, getting good leaders.
Yes.
And
certainly he must have been, well, he was an outstanding leader.
Oh, yeah, tremendous, and just totally wrapped up in it himself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I look back on it now, it was really, it ended the way it should. There was no use trying to hold the boys together. No use trying to perpetuate the troop because the quality of it was such that it couldn't have been maintained. And it was time the Perks got out of it for his own sake and his own good. He left Calgary. His next posting was Victoria, I believe. And he came to Victoria from, I think, the Wilder headquarters here from Calgary, and I think this was where he met Mrs. Perks.
That's right. Yeah, I think actually he was posted from, let's see now, I think you're right.
I think it was Calgary and Victoria.
Right.
It may have been
Calgary and Victoria, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. It was while he was in Calgary that he went to visit his mother and sister who were living in Saanich here.
Yeah.
And it was on a visit that he met first met his wife.
Well,
and they were married. She told me that that they'd known each other only 9 days, and that on the 9th day that he proposed, and she tells her rather humorous stories. But she being the first to be able to lasso him, I've wondered, and I don't know how much you might know about this, and I've asked him himself. He would be about in his 30. He'd be 31, 32 about this time.
Yeah.
He'd been in England, he'd been across Canada, up in the Yukon, he'd been overseas, a widely traveled man and all the rest of it, and how it was that he hadn't got married.
Well, I think most of his life, from the time he came to Canada, was in circumstances where he had very little exposure to women.
Yes, there's a lot in that.
See, he came out of that ranching, that disastrous ranching project in Alberta first. Probably no female companionship readily available under those circumstances, and then Alaska, and then
the
overseas,
world.
And so on. So my recollection of him was that he was, of course, a beautifully mannered man, and my goodness, I know that I thought then, and I ever thought ever since, what a catch he would have been for any insensible young woman, but he was shy in the presence of women.
Was he?
I think at that age, he was naturally withdrawn and shy, and that he found probably more companionship in men and boys, and with men and boys.
Well, now, did you meet him later in life?
Only in the sense of passing contacts after that.
He came back through Calgary after his first married.
That's right. And, yes, he got his wife back there.
Well, he didn't. He wasn't staying there. He was on his way east, I think. He was traveling through Calgary from here. I think he was going to some posting,
at
RMC. That's right, at Winnipeg.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was going east to Calgary. He stopped off in Calgary, and he brought Mrs. Perks around to call on my mother and myself.
Oh, yeah.
That's when I met her first.
Mm-hmm.
Then... after that, I kept track of where he was, but it was just really a sort of a Christmas card acquaintance from then on.
Mm.
See him once every 4 or 5 years, I guess, or maybe even less than that. He was at RMC, and he'd be here, he'd be there, he'd be back in Calgary occasionally, putting on a summer course at the old Sarcee military camp outside of Calgary.
Mm.
And I remember how pleased he was. My wife, a girl I later married, was also fond of horseback riding.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And we did a lot of horseback riding when we were courting, and I heard he was out at Sarcee.
Uh-huh.
So Dorothy and I rode out there one Sunday afternoon and hunted him up, and on the chance that he would be there, he was, and sort of walked in and surprised him and so on. And I remember how pleased he was. Appeared to be that I'd kept up my riding and so on. We didn't really have anything in common after that except our memories of the 4 years in which we saw a great deal of each other. And I guess that is still pretty much the case, except that now I wind up being a newspaper publisher in the same province in which he's a lieutenant governor, and I'm certainly very, very proud of my association with him. Anytime that it comes up, we open a new newspaper plant over in Vancouver in March, we had Perks came over and did the honors at the opening, and I got a great kick out of introducing him to people there. There's a mayor, and Bonner was representing the provincial government, and all dignitaries and newspaper people from all across Canada and so on. Of course, I got a great thrill out of introducing him as my former scoutmaster, you can imagine.
And Perks would be quick to pick it up.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Very quick.
Incidentally, there's a cute little thing there, you know. Somebody was out there. I think maybe it was this fellow who's here again tonight, the British High Commissioner, Linto.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody had laid on a helicopter to take Linto to Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
And they offered the Perks a ride back on this helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And they took off from Government House lawn, and Miss Perks, too.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little surprised to hear that, and they came over that day, and he dropped her off at her son's place, and they sent her over there, and he came along to our reception and mentioned that he had come over on a helicopter. And I said, gee, that's great, you know. It's too bad we didn't. If we'd known that, we might have arranged for you to land on the roof of our plant. And he said, oh, heavens, I wish I'd thought of that. And 4 or 5 times during the course of the time he was there with us, I'm so disappointed I didn't think of that.
Well.
He'd love to do it. You know, sort of arrive like Santa Claus
that's
on right. The roof of the plant, you know. You can see the dramatic moment in it,
yeah.
You know.
Oh, he'd get a bang out of that.
Yeah.
He's a man, I find, who's speaking to him, who enjoys life. My word, he enjoys life.
Yeah. Sure does.
I was wondering if you remembered anything during the period, during your scouting period, any humorous stories about him, or what have you?
Well, we had an awful lot of good times and countless laughs, but they were the kind of laughs that were hardly jokes. There's one here, I guess. Let me see. Well, here's the... I was mentioning building a bridge, you see. Now, this was across a stream, and we built these trusses and wired them together and eventually covered it with boughs and made this bridge across the stream. This was a project at one of our camps.
This is also at one of the camps, and this is Perks.
Oh, lovely.
And now wait a minute. I'll tell you. Here's somebody. Let me get my glass on. There's a boy in there who's living here in Victoria. He may not have mentioned him. And this is a lad that you really ought to talk to. Yeah, this little fellow here.
Mm-hmm.
Maxwell Bates. And he's one of Canada's outstanding painters, I think.
B-A-T-E-S.
B-A-T-E-S. His father was an architect in Calgary. And Maxwell had a lot of natural artistic talent. He went off to Britain before the war to study advanced study in art.
Mm-hmm.
And he was snapped up into one of these damn yeomanry regiments or something in the central England and rushed off to Europe right at the start of war. And he was taken prisoner when the fall of France,
mm-hmm.
and spent the entire period in a German prison camp.
Mm-hmm.
From 1940, spring of 40, I guess it was. Wasn't that from Dieppe, was it?
Yeah,
until he didn't get out till about 46. He came back and married, kept up his painting, and about 4 years ago had a very severe stroke. He's recovered enough from the stroke that he's continued his painting, and he lives here in Victoria.
Good.
He's well known in art world, and really an outstanding artist. He's gone fairly modern and abstract in his painting, but he's most highly regarded throughout the art world in Canada.
Good.
Maxwell Bates. Now, there's another lad here. I don't know if I can pick him up. It doesn't matter. His name is Jimmy Cowling.
Jimmy
Cowling, C-O-W-L-I-N-G. And he lives in Nanaimo. Here he is. So, character here.
Right.
Jimmy Cowling is in the garage business in Nanaimo, where he's been for 30 years or something, 35 years, all of that, I guess. That's myself, looking rather forlorn for some reason or other.
That's quite a group, though. I mean, to build three or four youngsters up into a group like that.
Bob Bowker, the oldest, I think he's the oldest active pilot in Air Canada now. I think he's number one now in Air Canada.
Bob?
Robert Bowker, B-O-W-K-E-R. Air Canada. He flies, he's got the real cushion route flying between Bermuda and Barbados or something like that. Lives in Bermuda. And,
right.
There's one other, it means nothing to me to point these out to you, but it sort of refreshes my memory.
Mm-hmm.
Vernon Hunter, the fellow who became the head driller for the Imperial Oil Company in Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
And drilled the famous Leduc well that brought in the whole post-war oil and gas boom in Alberta.
Is he still living?
Yes.
I don't know where, sir. Do you have any chance?
Last I heard was in Regina. He's at the Imperial Oil Company Exploration Department. Would soon turn him up if you wanted to seek him out.
Exploration Department.
Yes. I guess you'd call it exploration. He's a driller, anyway.
Yes.
That's his.
Did any of them become soldiers, do you know?
I don't think so. No, I don't believe any of them became permanent in the sense that Perks was.
Yes.
No, I don't think so. Don McLeod is not there. Don McLeod's a medical doctor in Jackson, Wyoming. He's one of the few people I've sort of kept track of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would readily want to do it, but I've got a feeling that the mortality rate in that group is unusually high. I couldn't imagine what reason that there could be any reason, but there are an awful lot of those boys here.
Mm-hmm.
Died over the years. Some in accidents. One of them working in the oil fields in Alberta as a load of pipe crushed him. Another one was asphyxiated sleeping in a tent when he was out on a oil well drilling crew as the younger brother of this fellow that whose name you wrote down, and mm-hmm. Jimmy Hunter. This was Vernon Hunter, younger brother. Mm-hmm.
Did he even look at
When I just go like this, or and recall the names, I think, my gosh, yes, he's there. He's there. Oh boy. Make sure you kind of hold it. Yeah.
But you said that, I think you were going to say that there was a humorous incident relating to one of the pictures that you had. Oh, yeah. I think this is the one. You see here, this is one that he has, I believe.
Well, there was a 100-mile dog race up at Banff one winter.
Mm-hmm.
They made a movie up there with the old... The first dog that was ever a movie star, the first Alsatian dog that was ever a movie star, was not Rin Tin Tin, it was a forerunner. Rin Tin Tin was called Strongheart.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And this dog was brought to Banff, and they made a movie there, built around a dog race, a 100-mile dog race. And we all went up as a bunch of kids. We went up to this to see this dog race. That's where this was taken. No, I've got a picture here somewhere. There, here it is. Yeah. Oh, this would be hilarious. See, we went up to Banff on another occasion and got Perks on skis. And, this is Perks on skis. They're starting off down the hill, you know.
Uh-huh.
Primitive kind of skis and primitive lashings, no poles and so on. And this was at the top and this was taken at the bottom.
Oh, I don't lovely.
Know, I don't know what happened to the picture in between, but I...
Lovely. He'd get a big bang on the scene. I don't know if you can bring it with you tonight, but he would get the... He'd be vastly amused, quite frankly, to see that.
Yeah. This was a first aid team. Another fellow in the Army that taught us first aid. You know, how to bandage mm-hmm. a broken arm and all that sort of nonsense. And we entered this team of five of us. This is the oil well driller friend again.
Mm-hmm.
This fellow's a sports editor of Calgary Albertan newspaper now. Anyway, this was a drill team that did first aid of all kinds, and mm-hmm. we entered a contest against St. John's Ambulance first aid teams from the mining towns around Alberta, where they had to maintain these things in case of mm-hmm. mine accidents and so on. And we entered and worked like the dogs at this thing, and stretcher drill and bandaging and everything, and went mm-hmm. to Banff where this contest was held, and it was up against all the rest were adults, and lo and mm-hmm. behold, we won it.
Oh.
We beat the all the adults. We beat everybody. We were the championship first aid team for Province of Alberta that year, and we all got medals. I still have the medal, the St. John's Ambulance thing. This was another occasion where a bunch of us went up to Banff, and through, I don't know how Perks arranged it, he was able to hire some pack horses, and we'd taken some drill in how to properly pack a horse and put the diamond hitch on, and we packed all our camping equipment on horses, and we walked and led the horses. And went off through the mountains, camping at night and hiking in the daytime, mm-hmm. but the horses to carry all the cargo, and this was, we were able to take better, more comfortable equipment, and much happier than packing it all on your back, you know, more of it. This was, these little snaps were taken
mm-hmm.
on that particular kind of a trip. Perks was along in that area.
Yeah.
As you can see, you're talking about the caps. These caps were very popular.
Yes, I remember wearing them myself, actually.
We weren't in Boy Scout attire on this occasion. We wore breeches, things to protect our legs because of the kind of country we were going through. And we were wearing more civilian dress. This was not an organized troop affair.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, an anecdote, I don't know. As I say, the kind of thing that when there was a bunch of us swimming at Banff in the middle of winter at that hot springs place, uh-huh. you know, where you can, with this zero or below the outside.
I didn't know, you know, it's not necessary to find a Namco, but I just thought that if anything stood out in your mind or whatever. Well, this is most interesting. Most interesting. Actually...
Well, I'm rambling now. I'm just trying to recall things that... But looking at these pictures or faces, maybe it might recall for me.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, kids were not interested in automobiles. They were so remote, the possibility that you'd ever own one in your lifetime, you know, that we didn't...
Did Perks have one himself?
No.
He didn't?
No, he never had an automobile there. He was a great walker.
Yes.
He could walk with anybody. Unless you were on horseback or in somebody else's motor car, I don't think he drove at all.
Mm-hmm.
Did I show the picture of him in that? This is at another campsite.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That's a good one.
This is on the Bow River, and oddly enough, it's either on or just adjacent to the land where Blythe of Perks was born.
Is that right?
Right up in the Bow Valley west of Calgary, but he didn't know her then. He didn't meet her then.
Well, I'll be darned.
But the main line of the CPR goes right along there, and the Bow River is just down in here. And this little campsite was between the main line of the railway and the river. And I think her place is just a little bit west of there, right in the community, right in the neighborhood, very much.
Well, well, well.
Yeah. Now that area is all... my niece lives there. My niece married a young man whose father made a considerable fortune in this Alberta oil, and... this lad is a graduate in agriculture at the University of Alberta, and my niece is graduated in commerce and a great accountant. And so the two of them got married, and they have a huge cattle ranch there, and she's the business manager of the cattle ranch.
Oh, well.
They're raising their four children right in there. This is right on their land.
Mm-hmm.
Very, you know, going into Calgary on the train, it's that lovely valley as it opens out from the from east of the Rockies, but before you come to...
Oh, what a delight.
To Calgary. Great country in the summertime. It's wonderful country for kids to grow up in. You know, all those hills to roam in those days. Boy, you're never at loss for something to do. And it didn't matter, really, the climate. We skied, we snowshoed, and if there was snow for you, or we hiked in the winter when it was sub-zero, if there was no snow, it didn't matter. We
still went.
Yeah. And...
leaving ahead for a moment, and again, I'm absolutely groping here. When you came out to Vancouver, more especially when you became a publisher of the province, that would be about what time?
January 1, 1959. Frank Ross was still the lieutenant governor then, and Perks was a member for Esquimalt. was in Diefenbaker's cabinet as Minister of Defense.
I'm just trying to wonder, or I was just wondering offhand, quite frankly, whether there'd be any relationship between your newspaper and Perks insofar as giving him support, but actually with him being over here, his writing being over here, and you being over there,
no. It
would be very little.
No, I'd have been happy if there'd been the opportunity to, but no, there was no connection or association there. It had certainly had nothing whatever to do with his appointment, but at the time that they were... The vacancy was there, and there was considerable speculation as to who was going to succeed Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Perks' name was mentioned because he was a good friend of Diefenbaker's, and Diefenbaker was known to have thought so highly of him.
Mm-hmm.
But the question was whether or not Perks could swing it financially, I believe. And... I ran into a little bit of chivving in the minds of people who wondered if this fellow could handle a job, and I jumped on him pretty fast whenever I heard that. And I tell you, our paper, of course, was most laudatory about the appointment when it was made.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly after that, the first opportunity, I came over and saw him.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first time I had seen him directly in about 20 years.
Is that right?
I guess, because